Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB in Freeport, New York, and live streaming on the web at am1240wgbb.com. And very, very excited to talk to my next two guests, because I played a lot of outsider music on this program. I played people like Wesley Willis and Shuby Taylor, and I've had Art Paul Schlosser as a guest, the street musician from Milwaukee, and it's just something that I've loved ever since I was a kid, listening to novelty songs or listening to Dr. Demento. And then growing up into my teen years and discovering Frank Zappa and Captain Beefheart and that whole era and that whole sound coming out of the West Coast, discovered also through a friend of mine a two-record set called An Evening with Wildman Fisher, and the cover of it gives you sort of a clue as to what, in a way, the cover is actually more knowing and savvy than some of the rest of the music is, because he's basically holding a butcher knife to someone that we presume is his mother. And that actually is also a clue to his home life and his personality. We don't have Wildman Fisher on the show with us today, unfortunately, but we do have people who got close to him for a bit of time very, very recently, and they did that in order to make a film, a documentary of his life. I've not seen it. It's coming to the South by Southwest Film Festival this month, so I'm just can't wait to see the story of Wildman Fisher being told by Jeremy and Josh Lubin, who are on the phone with me now. Jeremy, Josh, you there?
Hey, Dave, how you doing? Actually, it's Josh Rubin and Jeremy Lubin.
Your kid is Rubin and Lubin?
Yes.
Oh,
hey.
Brother.
Very strange coincidence. That's why we go by the name the Ubin Twins.
The Ubin Twins. Well, how did you guys meet?
We met actually in, Jeremy, what was it, like the second grade?
Second grade,
and we've just been vibing creatively together ever since then. So we had a rap group that we formed in the seventh grade. So,
well, how old
we've
are you
kind
guys?
Of been on the same wavelength for a long time. So this project was just right for us.
Now, who was just talking? That was
Me, Josh. Really.
Me, Josh. Okay. And now, and how old roughly? In your 30s or late 20s or what?
No, Jeremy's 28.
Uh huh.
And I'm 27.
Cool. Cool. So how did you come across... See, I was listening to Wildman Fisher like 20, 25 years ago, but it was a much more recent thing for you guys.
Mm-hmm.
What
this
happened?
This is actually a good story. First of all, we probably would have found out about him sooner or later, I'm sure. But I was eating lunch in a restaurant called California Chicken Cafe in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And I was by myself. I was wearing a suit. And... this guy all of a sudden comes up to me, and he looked like a street person. His skin was dirty. He was wearing tattered clothing, and he gets right in front of my face as I'm eating, and he goes, "Do you know who I am?" And I go, "No, I'm sorry, I don't." And he goes, "Well, I'm Wildman Fisher. Have you ever heard of me?" And I go, "No, should I have heard of you?" And he goes, "Well, I was discovered by Frank Zappa, and Zappa produced my first album, and then Rhino Records formed around me. I was the first artist on Rhino Records and made three more albums." And you know, I was kind of looking at him, not really sure what to think. If all that was true, why was he appearing like a street person? And he went on and on about how Solomon Burke saw him perform at a talent show and then took him on tour with him and, you know, all this other stuff.
And this was apropos of nothing. He just sort of appeared. You know, you didn't ask him, you weren't, like, seeking him out, as you know, certain acolytes would have, considering now you know of his fame.
Exactly. He just appeared kind of lonely, and he was looking for someone to talk to.
And probably a sandwich, yeah.
And what happened was, I went home that night, and just out of curiosity, I went on the Internet, and I did a little Google search on him. And I realized that everything he told me was absolutely true.
Yeah.
He was pretty well-documented on the Internet. And, Josh and I were living together at the time. We were roommates.
Mm-hmm.
And I told Josh about this, and we were really interested to hear these albums. So we went out, we found a used copy of Evening With on LP. And
By the way, it's not on CD. We'll get into that in a bit. But they never released it on CD, yeah.
Not on CD yet. We went out, we found a copy of Evening With, and we played it, and we were just absolutely blown away We have never heard anything like it. It was actually during a time when both of us were kind of, you know, disillusioned with music. We were looking for something new to, you know, kind of make that type of impression on us. And we just, the song Wild Man Fisher's Story is really what did it. You know, it's an autobiographical song. And we just realized how complex of a character he was. And, you know, we just thought, you know, we kind of, he seemed pretty accessible. And we thought, you know,
if you knew where to find him, yeah. So how did you end up, I mean, it was one thing for him to appear. How did you track him down again? It's not like, I don't think he has an apartment.
We made a, we actually made contact. The guy who introduced us was a Howard Stern lackey.
Okay.
For lack of a better word. Melrose Larry Green.
Okay, yeah.
Melrose Larry Green was actually serving as Wild Man's like ad hoc agent at the time. And we set up a couple meetings with him because as his you know, quote unquote agent, he was, you know, kind of, he was his guardian basically, because Larry, he has a very close circle of friends who are all looking out for his best interests, and sometimes he can't handle a lot of his business affairs. He needs some extra help. He's been burned so many times.
Yeah. And also maybe we should backtrack just a little bit and let people know a bit more about the Wild Man Fisher story. I mean, he was an outsider artist. He did a lot of his stuff a cappella, made money to an extent, singing songs
Fisher,
on the street.
Wild Man Fisher basically was an abused child. He was in an unfortunate situation as a child. He had a very strange and abusive mother, coupled with an early onset of manic depression and paranoid schizophrenia. Now, in order to deal with his terrible childhood that was going on, he used to go into his room because he had no friends and he had no one to turn to. And what the disease was, you know, making his mind do was just making him, giving him the ability to create these one-of-a-kind, original, amazing manic songs at a very young age. And he did this to cope with his family life, and also because he didn't know what was happening inside his own mind. He wasn't diagnosed yet.
Yeah.
So that was basically the start of the Wild Man Fisher story. He then, once the schizophrenia hit, he then declared to the world that he was no longer shy, and he took to the streets and beaches of Los Angeles and decided to make a living by selling his songs to passerby for 10 cents a pop. So that's where really the legend of Wild Man Fisher starts. Everybody in L.A. who we've spoken to, who was around UCLA, who was around, you know, all the beaches, Santa Monica, down to the Sunset Strip is where he's really famous, but you know, everybody knows who Wild Man Fisher is because he would go up to you and say, "Do you want to hear his new song for a dime?" And it was, the amazing thing was is that it really was an amazing new kind of song, and that's what he pitched people.
You're listening to Dave's Gone By, and with me are the Ubin Twins, filmmakers who did a documentary about Wild Man Fisher, his life and career in the music biz, including the Frank Zappa years.
He made an amazing double album with Frank Zappa called An Evening with Wild Man Fisher, which is a cult classic. And after he kind of had a falling out with Frank, he then took to selling peanuts for the Dodgers.
Peanuts! Peanuts! Get your red hot peanuts! I'm selling peanuts for the Dodgers! You can't tell the players without your peanuts!
But then he was sort of semi-rediscovered by Barnes & Barnes, guys from Fishheads, and actually one of them is Billy Mumy, whom people
may
remember from Lost in Space. Yep. And they linked up with Rhino and gave, and as Wild Man told you, he was the first Rhino recording artist. His song, Go to Rhino Records on Westwood Boulevard, was, you know, their theme song. Amazing. This was before, obviously, they started doing box sets of the Kinks, you know.
Yeah, he started the whole piece. He basically was, you know, helped jumpstart Rhino Records.
Label formed around him, literally.
Yeah, he was the first. Wild Man Wildman Fisher Go to Rhino Records is Rhino LP 001.
And he did three albums for them over the course of about 10 or 15 years. So, but anyway, I jumped there just to give people some background. So getting back to your story of being hooked up with, you know, through Melrose Larry Green,
right,
of the Stern Show,
mm-hmm,
and again getting to meet him a second time. Because now you wanted to meet him. You know, the first time he's just in your face. Now suddenly, you know, you're stalking him in a manner of speaking. And how did it go?
It went amazing. Basically, we met him right near our house. We were living in Hollywood at the time, right off Melrose.
Okay.
And, you know, the thing with Larry is that he'll meet with you if you buy him a dinner. That's his thing. So we bought him a dinner, and he actually was with his friend, Fugly the Clown, who's a L.A. performance artist, who I think is brilliant.
Oh, okay, cool.
So they came together, and he, you know, he just kind of relegated us with his amazing stories. I think it was like a 3.5-hour, 4-hour meeting. He, you know, because Larry loves to talk, and he loves to talk about himself and about all his experiences and mishaps and, you know, adventures.
Did you bring a tape recorder?
Fascinating because, you know, all of it's true.
Not only that, but he would just randomly burst into song. He would just start singing songs from, you know, the Evening With album or, you know, one of the Rhino albums, which was also, you know, pretty entertaining.
What restaurant would he be allowed to do this in?
It was a place called Hot Wings Cafe on Melrose.
Yeah. It wasn't one of the high-end restaurants.
No.
Okay. Well, cool. So, and then at what point did you go from being like, oh, my God, we had this wonderful dinner with the unbelievable Wildman Fisher? How did that sort of morph into, we have to tell this guy's story on film?
It started off when Jeremy brought home the album, really, and we you know, hit play on the record player. It was just, there's so much information in that album, you know, it runs the gamut from an amazing, you know, musical brilliance that's happening in this collaboration with the great Frank Zappa, late great Frank Zappa, to this really sad and upsetting story of his childhood that he tells so truthfully. And because, you know, one of the early theories that we took on was that because of his paranoid schizophrenia, it's kind of enabled him to have this pure output of art, so to speak. So, you know, just hearing this man's story, you know, some people could perceive it as, you know, entertaining or freakish, but, you know, we saw it as just, like, brutally honest.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. We're talking to the Ubin Twins, makers of the documentary Derailroaded, about Wildman Fisher, and asking them what gave them the idea to do this film.
You know, Jeremy and I have been looking at and collecting records for forever, and we're always looking for, like, the greatest, the best thing out there.
Right.
And like you said, we were really disillusioned. And it's just the truth in what he was doing. Whether, you know, some people might not find it, you know, melodically or harmonically pleasing, but it was just so real, and just kind of...
And funny, fun, and joyous.
Yeah, it was just everything. It was funny, fun, entertaining, original.
It inspired us to, you know, put something together to, you know, seek Larry out and start filming him.
Well, had you done creative... I mean, you said you were in a rap group when you were in seventh grade, but had you done creative projects as adults?
No. We went to different colleges. So, you know, we'd always be communicating, oh, did you hear this album? You know, it would just be that kind of thing.
But we both ended up moving out to Hollywood with filmmaking in mind. And we were both looking for a project to create together, and this just kind of fell into our lap. It was like right time, right place. We were wondering why there had never been a documentary made about Wildman Fisher. It's just such an amazing subject and just had to be done.
Well, there was a point for, I guess, about 10 years where nobody knew, I mean, people knew where he was roughly, but he was staying in flop houses or on the streets, but you couldn't pinpoint him. And if he did, he might attack you. I mean, if his medication was off a little bit.
Well, I don't think he would attack you. I think
he's a pretty lonely person, and he's always looking for people to talk to.
Yeah, I think unfortunate rumor that's gone around, revolving around about this guy's life is that he's violent, and I think that's...
Well, he's had episodes of throwing people's stuff out windows, I think, and there are tales told on the net that seem to be believable, where he's the guest that's great when he stays for 5 hours and horrible when he stays 2 days, that kind of thing.
In terms of punching people out,
he's just
a sweetheart of a guy. He gets frustrated, and he is a big man. I think he's like 6'3" and 6'4", but he can be not violent, but just use his physical body to let you know that he's unhappy. He uses that to his advantage, definitely. But in terms of being violent, that's an unfortunate rumor that's been circulating for a while, I think, about him, and
I'm glad to hear it.
Not true. Yeah, no, he's a peaceful person.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. We're talking with Jeremy Lubin and Josh Rubin about their film, Derailroaded. So when you started to say, okay, we're going to make a film, what did that involve? I mean, where'd you get the budget? How much was the budget? And how'd you start collecting and getting material apart from the interviews with him? But I assume you excavated footage and posters and things like that.
Oh, it was a 3.5-year journey.
Oh, wow.
We started off doing it, it just... The first, I think, 6 months were spent courting Larry and, with trying to get him to sign a contract, basically.
Hmm.
And finally he did that, and that's when, we got the green light from his to film, people who were his admirers who wouldn't have done it without his consent. People like Dr. Demento. And then people like, Weird Al Yankovic started falling into place. And then once you get people like that, it becomes an interesting project to a lot more people. Also, we have footage from every single decade of this guy's life, starting from, when he was 3 years old, his old movies. His family or his collaborated with us. So
his family meaning his what? His brother David?
His brother David.
And is there anybody else left?
He has another brother named Norman.
Oh.
Who is somebody who we were told definitely not to contact for different reasons. But, we didn't contact him. And that's that.
Yeah, Norman actually is, from what we understand, he's pretty much bedridden. He's not, too healthy these days, and... Yeah, we're just kind of told to, leave him alone.
But the parents are dead, and the and so it's basically the brother David is the connection, and he helped you with that archival footage, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, once he met with us and saw some footage and realized that we really respected Larry, and were trying to bring him to the public, just because he's so underground. He realized that we weren't trying to exploit him in a negative way, and he was definitely more than willing to share, his thoughts and feelings about what happened with his family and very deep, sometimes unsettling things. It's a story that is unsettling, that is oddly funny and humorous at times, and it just runs the gamut in terms of emotions. So,
how much footage did you shoot to break it down? I guess it's a 90-minute film, or
hundreds of hours.
Hundreds with it.
Hundreds.
Wow. Oh my
hundreds
god.
Hundreds of hours. Yeah, I mean if we do, when we take this thing to DVD, there's so much DVD bonus material. It's insane.
Yeah, well, I mean Larry was very accessible, and he's not a very busy guy, so it was great. We had the opportunity to film him pretty much whenever we wanted.
Well, but there were, it came in spurts a lot of the time. Sometimes you know, he's a paranoid, schizophrenic, manic, depressive man. So, you know, he gets in moods.
Right.
Often.
Was there ever a time when he thought you were against him?
It was a very touchy thing to film
yeah.
him.
Well, was there ever a time when he was worried that you guys were going to be against him or that...
Yes.
It was a bit, yeah.
Oh, yes.
about he'd call us in the morning. And that's one of the things about Larry. He loves using the telephone, you know. That's kind of his main line to the rest of the world. But he would call us in the morning sometimes before we go to work. And he'd say, you know, I'm so happy, you know, that we're doing this. I'm so happy that you guys are my best friends. Because, you know, we take him out to dinner all the time.
Right.
We really do love the guy. I mean, we take good care of him. You know, we see that he's fed, you know, and he's being taken care of, and that he's brushing his teeth, that kind of thing. And then, you know, he'd just get into some kind of paranoid tailspin and just, you know, you guys are to blame, you know, I can't believe you guys are doing this, blah, blah, blah. So,
oh boy.
It was definitely a trying experience, and I'd never dealt with anybody like that before, but you learn real quick how to, you know, and you have to.
What do you do?
You have to just approach it extremely sensitively, you know?
Well,
I mean,
yeah.
It just, because you know in 3 minutes after he's, you know, after he stops berating you for scheming against him, he's going to say, you know what, I take that back. You guys are my best friends. So,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, and that's...
Is he on, he must be on meds of some sort.
Well... And right now he's being taken care of, yeah. So
okay, I mean I admit I was rather shocked. I mean I've always the last I had seen of him there was a website. I mean I've never seen him in person. I live on the East Coast anyway, but there was a website that had a footage of him. They found him on you know on the street and he was in a good mood and it was his 56th birthday. And
yeah,
he made
now Myers.
Phone. What sorry? What was that?
I'm 56 years old today. Big deal.
Who cares? Who cares? But at least I'm still alive. That was
right.
his song for them. It was great. But that was it. I mean, and then there was footage of him performing somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first time I'd actually ever physically seen him perform. And he was already not old, but well into middle age and
right.
doing, you know, I'm the meanie. And
right.
that was it. And then, 5 years ago, I saw that on the web. And then, bam, we're flipping channels at night. And there he is on Jimmy Kimmel.
Right.
What was up with that? How did that occur? Was that from Melrose Larry or what?
Yes.
Yeah, kind of it was. A producer from the Jimmy Kimmel show happened to be a big fan of Wild Man Fisher and was trying to, I guess supposedly trying to book him for a long time. And Melrose Larry Green said, you know, I have access to Larry. I'll put you in touch with Josh and Jeremy. And what happened was the producer called us because, you know, we were the only ones that were in contact, you know, with Larry at the time. We were the only ones that actually had his phone number. And so we kind of arranged for Larry to go in there and try out for the show. And the audition went really well, and they called us back and said, okay, well, we want to have Larry on the show. And, you know, we took Larry to the show, and yeah, it went really well.
It I was so dread. When they first called the name, I was in shock because like it can't be, it couldn't be, and then of course it was. And
yep.
then I was nervous while he was doing it, and then I had recorded it and played it back, and I was like, you know what? He did all right. He knows how to work a crowd.
Absolutely, he's been doing it for a long time.
So I was very. Has there been any positive? I the only word I can think of is fallout. I mean, that was a negative word, but since that exposure, I mean, has there been now a bump in what he is doing? Here he was in the public eye, at least for 2 or 3 minutes, on
right.
a major late-night talk show. So did that lead to...
He has told me that he has watched the tape over 15,000 times.
Oh, dear God. Okay. And
I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true. All I know is that he has a VCR, he has a VHS copy of the tape, and he
yeah.
has a TV. And he doesn't have a job, and he doesn't like leaving the house too much nowadays.
Oh.
So,
does he live
saying that he's enjoyed that, watching that, is an understatement.
Oh, I actually, my question was more about the. Did that lead to a concert? No, did it lead to a concert? Did it lead to?
No.
Okay.
No, I mean, I think he's satisfied at this point. You know, I mean, he's been Wildman Fisher for 60 years, you know, or for 50 years, mm-hmm. ever since he, you know, became the guy who was singing songs for a dime on the Sunset Strip. So, you know, with, you know, marginal success, underground success, which is, you know, not what he set out to do. He set out to be, you know, as the Evening with Wildman Fisher album states, bigger than Bob Dylan, bigger than the Beatles. So,
Well, that didn't work.
No, so he's comfortable, you know, in his role, you know, as Wildman Fisher, and he's really excited for this movie to come out, you know. We've been doing it for a long time. We've been perfecting it.
And now it is finished. It's ready to go. You know, it's entered in the festival at the South by Southwest Festival, which is where again?
It's in Austin, Texas, and it's going to be premiering, I think, on March 13th.
And then what? I mean, you have the film done. Do you have a distributor, or is that what the festival is all about?
That's basically what the festival is for.
Cool. Do you see it as theatrical release? Or
absolutely.
Great.
We do, definitely.
Cool. I mean, yeah. I would love to see it come to New York and Film Forum or the Angelica or something like that.
We'd love to bring it to New York.
It would be major. I mean, I guess you have to premiere it in San Francisco, but after that, you know, wherever. Or does the South by Southwest count as the premiere? I don't know how these things work.
South by Southwest, we intend to show it as, you know, at least a few more festivals. And, you know, and then we'll see. We'd love for it to go theatrical. You know, that's really ultimately what we want with this.
What would you say is the most surprising or amazing or poignant story that came out of this or that he told that either made it to the film or he ultimately said, you know what, please don't put that in?
It's basically the story of his present-day struggle, which we documented, you know, throughout the film. A lot of the film is looking back on his life, but I think... the greatest story of all is actually, you know, him dealing with his disease and his present situation. And we actually, you know, we actually captured that. And I think it's extremely moving, and I think that's going to get the most reaction. Even if you have no idea who this man is, even if you don't care about his music, you know,
maybe after the movie you will, that's
yeah,
the point.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we've been getting extremely positive reactions from a lot of people. So, you know, in terms of Wildman Fisher being limited, you know, I don't think so. I don't think his career is over at all. I think with this movie, the legend is just going to grow.
Well, that also leads to, I know we only have another minute or two left, but what about new songs or a new album? Is there any talk or I'm sure he must have, you know, 500 songs that he can winnow down into 15 or 20 for a new record, but no talk of that?
At this point, there's no talk about a new album. You know, I mean, who knows what could happen, but one of the great things about our movie is that our movie will be, the vehicle for a lot of his new songs.
Cool.
You know, in our movie, there's tons of songs that you've never heard before.
Oh, fabulous.
Some of them Larry made up right on the spot as we were filming them. Some of them he made up in the, 70s, 80s, 90s, and they were just never released. So,
and they're amazing songs.
Oh, yes.
They're brilliant.
Well, then I, one word for you guys. I mean, soundtrack, please.
Yeah.
You know,
and, you know, we're trying.
And the other question I want to ask, and I should have asked this before, I'll probably re-edit this so it's somewhere in the middle of the interview, because I don't want to tail-end it with this, but one of the people I noticed, first of all, you have a fabulous trailer, and if people want to see it, they can go to your website. It's derailroaded.com?
Yeah, www.derailroaded.com.
Yeah, the trailer really makes you want to see the movie, even if you're not a huge Wildman Fisher fan like I am. And I noticed that you interviewed Gail Zappa.
Right.
Now, in the lore of Wildman Fisher, and some of that you've already debunked today, she's kind of the meanie. She's something of the bad guy, because it tended, I think, to be she who disallowed the Wildman Fisher, the first double album, to be put on CD. She always felt it was disrespectful to him. He was a sick man, and that's why, you know, let him be, and don't put this music out in a format that all these young kids might get a hold of and start making fun of him or something. What's the deal with her?
Well, see, that's actually not true. You know, that was just something that, you know, was spread around the internet. You know, those were definitely not Gail's words. Gail does definitely respect Larry's work and, you know, has been talking through the years about possibly re-releasing it. You know, there's no date set for that, but...
I think in the film, you know, she expresses her feelings on Larry, and that's the only way that if you see it, then you'll realize, you know, that, you know, we clear up a lot of the myths surrounding that.
Oh, I know, but it's like everything that Frank Zappa ever did, every fart he ever laid down is on some, beyond the bootleg, is on some major re-release for Ryko or whatever,
right,
Barking Pumpkin.
True.
And yet, this incredibly important album for both Zappa and certainly for Wildman Fisher has been held back for 20 years on, I assume, just her say-so.
I guess it's kind of easy to assume that because a record, you know, has not been released for all this time that, you know, maybe she just does not want to. But that's not true. You know, Gail doesn't do many public interviews. And, I think that she has a lot of records to release. I mean, you've never seen Frank Zappa's vault.
Fair enough. Okay.
It's completely packed. There's always plenty of stuff on her plate. And there's just so many projects going at one time that, sometimes time just doesn't allow her to release certain things that maybe aren't as high, you know, in demand as other projects.
But I think people who are interested in this film,
yeah,
and people who are interested in Wildman Fisher and people who are also interested in Frank Zappa, should let it be known that they want this album to come out.
It's so important.
Yeah. It's story, and it's so important to Frank's story.
I'm sure when Rhino was putting together the Fisher King, which is all three Wildman Fisher albums on Rhino, plus all like the extraneous material that they could get, including his duet with Rosemary Clooney, and including all sorts of cool stuff, I'm sure they must have approached and said, you know, it's time. So that's why I'm just wondering, you know, maybe, as you said, maybe the documentary, knock wood, will bring that wonderful record to life.
We hope so.
Now, what are you, now that I realize you have to concentrate on this film and getting it out there and marketing it and finding the distributor, are you guys working on anything else creatively since that?
Not together right now. We actually have been working so closely together that,
you hate each other.
Yes.
Okay.
We don't hate each other, but we're just you know.
Well, where do you
taking
guys,
a break for a while?
Where do you guys work? I mean, I know you've got jobs to go back to after we do this interview, and that's why I'm going to end it in a moment or two. But what do you guys do when you're not doing the movie?
Secret agents.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Well, but you blew your cover because now I know you're secret.
Right.
I know that you're the Ubin twins,
right.
Ruben and Lubin, and I know that you've got this movie that, God willing, will be coming to a theater near us within the year, I hope. I hope you do great at the South by Southwest Festival. And most of all, I want to thank you both
Thanks,
for
Dave.
Taking the time to talk with us about Wildman Fisher.
Cool, man.
Pleasure. Our pleasure.